The doctrine of discovery is the current system of laws and policies that justify the removal of land from indigenous peoples. These laws are rooted in church doctrines that originated in the 15th century.
Together, we will uncover this deep structure of colonization that systematically deprives indigenous peoples of human rights.
I'm Sherry Hostetler, and I helped start a coalition of Anabaptist people of faith that seek to dismantle the doctrine of discovery. I'm also a Mennonite pastor in San Francisco.
And I'm Sarah Augustine, and I also helped start this coalition. As an activist and scholar, I'm the descendant of the Tewa people and a displaced person. This is the Dismantling the Doctrine of Discovery podcast.
In this episode, Sarah and I reflect on our previous episode, which was an interview with Richard Heinberg, specifically how that interview relates to the message of our new book, So That We and Our Children May Live, Following Jesus and Confronting the Climate Crisis. We discuss why we are hopeful or optimistic or excited. We actually can't quite figure out which word is most appropriate. Despite the poly crisis that we describe in our new book and that Richard describes in that interview, the term poly crisis refers to the multiple ecological crises we are facing. Climate change is only one of them. We also have a biodiversity crisis, a plastics crisis, a toxic chemicals in our bodies and waterways and really everything crisis, a groundwater depletion crisis. I could go on. I won't. But I invite you to listen to this podcast if you want to understand why Sarah and I are hopeful in the face of these multiple cascading interacting crises. We also talk about why conspiracy theories like QAnon are actually onto something that's true, and why it's important to be in kinship and solidarity with the working class and poor people who believe these theories. I just want to note that this is not a polished conversation. It was a shoot from the hip one that we weren't even sure we were going to use. I think that makes it kind of fun, though. Also, at the beginning of this episode, we refer to a portion of the interview with Richard that wasn't included in the previous interview with him. It's a segment where he talks about the work of complexity scientist Peter Turchin. If you want to listen to that 7-minute portion of the interview, and here comes a shameless plug, you can do so by subscribing to Sarah's and my new Substack, where you will get a weekly reflection on ecological justice, decolonization, faith, and where we find hope for our future. We're beginning that Substack at the end of November, and I will link to it in our show notes. And I hope you enjoy our conversation. Thank you. I think the thing that's valuable about this analysis is that it's basically telling anybody who is still on the fence about whether everything has to change that it really does. Like, if you think somehow you're going to be able to protect yourself because you're a white, educated, Western person, it basically, like, it's almost like you might as well cast your lot with indigenous and other vulnerable people, because you're actually really vulnerable yourself.
Yeah, you're in the bucket now with the rest of us.
You're in the bucket now with the rest of you. And I think that's what's helpful about what Richard says, including that last section of our interview where he was talking about Peter Turchin and societal collapse once it reaches a certain level of, as he put it, inequality and et cetera. And then I think that I think in our book, what we're calling people to is to imagine new systems and to imagine to engage with indigenous thought leaders about what does it mean to imagine new systems. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't at the same time work on changing laws and policies to that can provide more immediate benefit and redress to indigenous people. But I think that indigenous people, from what I understand, for basically centuries have said, this isn't working. This cannot sustain itself, and something else has to take its place. Mm. I don't know if that's fair, Sarah.
I agree with that. And I think that there, so we're kind of operating in both realms at once. We are imagining the new future and trying to figure out what will it take to build that. And we're also in this stance of reform at the same time, working within the world that we are living in now.
Right.
And so, you know, I think both of those things are true. And I'm not sure if Richard's comments are really in the reform frame or in the new world frame, but probably it's just sort of motivation for both of those.
I think it's probably motivation for both, although I think that he's probably a little bit more in the sort of new world frame because he's providing so many, you know, practical reasons why this way that we think we're going to just continue the game isn't going to happen. So like just basically give up your techno optimism. Therein lies ruin, you know. the game's kind of up. In fact, he's got a book called The Party's Over, which is about how the decline of cheap fossil fuels are going to basically cause, like, we can't just be in this drunken party land. The dominant culture has been in for a long time now, decades now. And I think that, you know, I mean, I think the through line to what we're about was what you said there at one point where you were talking about we need to demand change. We need to demand that these things change.
I would like to hear you, Sherry, talk more about why you're feeling optimistic.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I shouldn't even say that because I feel like it's maybe not true. Actually, somebody at the Rooted and Grounded conference said, where's your optimism come from? And I said, I don't know that I'm optimistic, but I'm hopeful. And I'm not even sure I can tell you what the difference is between those two things. Hopeful, I mean, in the sense of like, in the very long term, I feel like the systems of life will win out. And that we're seeing that turning happening because the systems of death can no longer sustain themselves. And so they are eventually, and I'm not saying that's not going to come with great suffering. I really do believe it will. It already has caused great suffering for hundreds of years now. But I do think that we're seeing this turning where the systems of death are like they've cannibalized themselves so much that they can no longer sustain themselves and something has to change. But that's maybe different than optimism.
Yeah, you know, I feel very optimistic. Well, I shouldn't say optimistic. I should say I feel very excited. I feel very excited because we are a lucky generation that is in this time of profound change. And so, you know, the way it works from my point of view, when you have systems change, it goes on for us in a pretty predictable cycle for multiple generations. And then there's some tipping point and then you have systems change.
Right.
And we're lucky enough to be alive during this time of change, because just as you said, we can't go on.
Right.
And so that gives me great hope. And I go back to this scripture, which is, I'm not going to say it right, that when Jesus says, you know, I don't think that I've come to bring peace, but to divide. And he talks right. about splitting even households, father against son, mother-in-law against daughter-in-law, and how those words are actually, those are words of hope for the oppressed.
Right.
Because peace is often construed, what we call peace is often just the stabilization or reinforcement of the status quo. And Jesus was talking about something else. He was not coming with a message of the status quo, reinforcing the status quo to keep things copacetic. He was talking about systems change and radical change. And so we are the lucky people who get to be alive and where our contribution really means something. Like, for example, when you're in the beginning of startup, it's so exciting when you're starting up a, a project or a business, because, you know, you get to say what it's going to be, you know, then the subsequent generations just have to live with the structure you built.
Right. So that's right.
I feel like, hey, we get to speak into what could be. Right. And I find that really exciting. Right. And of course it's also terrifying because, we are not alone. We're not in power that we get to be the ones to determine, but we do have the opportunity to organize for right. a different world.
Right. Yeah. I think that's a very good summary of why I feel hopeful. We're at the tipping point. And something is changing. It's not even that it has to change. It's already changing. Mm-hmm. Everybody sees that and feels it and has different responses to it, as Richard said, sometimes with conspiracy and paranoia. But I also wonder if that's because people just don't have adequate, you know, like, would those same people be susceptible to these kinds of non-reality-based conspiracy theories if they actually had access to a reality-based understanding of what's going on in the world?
Yeah, I have so much sympathy for people who feed into conspiracy theories because our entire system is based on a conspiracy.
Yes.
The conspiracy
yes.
of the powerful elites designing a system that benefits themselves and to the detriment of everything else in creation. And if that's not a conspiracy, I don't know what you call it. I mean, all of our laws and policy are arranged in a way to do that. And Richard was just saying, hey, you know, this is really the past couple decades. And I'm thinking it was originated with the Bretton Woods institutions. And so those institutions were created to structurally ensure the domination of the world by Europe and the United States. So they built that system. Yes, of course it's stable. It's all working. All resources, all power flows to that empire. You know, of course it's stable. Yeah. That doesn't mean that everybody enjoys it. It's totally dehumanizing for nearly everyone.
Right. And actually, I think Richard would have the same historical understanding that you just said, you know, in fact, I think I've read stuff he's written about what you're just describing. But yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. I mean, I've often felt like people who believe in conspiracy theories are onto something. They're onto the fact that there is a conspiracy theory, like there is a conspiracy going on. It's just it's a misplaced understanding of what that conspiracy actually is. And sometimes actually, yeah, I don't know, like, you know, so interesting when I think of QAnon, powerful elites are working behind the scenes to cause great harm to your children. Yeah. I mean, how do you describe the current crisis we're in?
I mean, I can't imagine. I mean, this is sort of my general sympathy and alliance with the working class. A lot of the mm-hmm. people that are involved in those conspiracy theories are people from the working class because they are sensing that their opportunities are worsening, that actually their position in the world is going backwards. And that is true. And that is because of a conspiracy for sure. So I even think about the conspiracy around the COVID vaccine. And I think there's some basis to that, and this is what I mean by that. Obviously, I don't believe in all the non-science stuff, but what I'm saying is that there are powerful forces that are aligning themselves to benefit from a pandemic. Yes, that is true. It's not false. It's true. It's the basis of capitalism. Everything is designed to do that. So, you know, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't take the vaccine, but it absolutely is a conspiracy to take a difficult situation and for that situation to be profitable for an elite few, and that we would use government resources to make that happen. Yes, all of that is true. I don't disagree with it. And so, you know, years ago when we were first working in the rainforest with Mattawai people, And they were saying, hey, you know, we're not going to give you our hair. You know, we were collecting hair samples to demonstrate mercury load in their bodies since they were living in contaminated environments contaminated by mining. And they said, no, we won't give you our hair. I'm not going to give it to you. And so there were people who said, oh, you know, that's because they believe in voodoo and they're afraid that you're going to go do some ceremony with their hair. But I came to realize what they believed actually is that I don't know you. You're going to take my hair. You're going to do something with it. And I don't have control over what that is.
Right.
And that is absolutely true.
Right. Right.
Is there a conspiracy that you're going to take my hair and use it for your own benefit? Yes, because scientists do that. They take that hair, they write that study, they publish that study, and then they do benefit from that.
And then they get tenure. And yes. Then they.
Exactly. And so when you reframe it and you say, look, community, here's the technology for you. Do you want to do your own study? They say, yes, they actually do want to know about the mercury load in their own body. And so from my point of view, I think this polarization is like, oh, look at all the ignorant dummies who, you know, blah, blah, they hate the vaccine. It's like, there's a reason, you know what I mean? There is a reason for that. It's because, vulnerable people and poor people have been deceived and have their suffering has been used for the gain, the economic and political gain of the mighty. That's not false. So that's where I feel like, hey, we have to sit down with working class people and really address those interests because those interests are true. We are not polarized. Those of us who believe that to be true, we're in kinship with these folks. You know what I mean? They're not dummies. Yeah.
Well, it reminds me of a conversation I was having with a friend who's kind of sort of starving student, you know, mode. And she said she went to one dentist who was just in private practice. Nothing against dentists in private practice, but she said, you know, this person was like, oh my gosh, your teeth are a mess. You need so much work. And she's like, well, I can't afford that work. And so then she went to the dental school where a student looked at her teeth and then this, all their work has to be looked at by a professor. And the professor said, you know, like, I actually don't think we have to really do anything on your teeth right now. He said, like, some cavities actually self-heal. And she said, what? He said, yeah, sometimes cavities self-heal. And she said, how interesting it was to get this difference between somebody who had to make he was in the system where he had to make a profit. This person in private practice had to make a profit off of her. And so great surgeries were needed and great, I don't know if it's surgeries, but great interventions were needed. And then she goes to the school where there is not a profit incentive because they're training students and they don't have their, you know what I mean? And she actually gets like this information of like, let's just wait a while. Maybe your body will self-heal. Mm. Like, so I think it speaks to the way that our, and I think actually often too with poorer people, how much dentistry trauma there is. You know, like you grow up in a place where you maybe, like for all sorts of reasons, you have bad teeth, and then how that just becomes really so much a health issue as you get older and kind of a source of shame. And then it's like you get sort of in the system where people have to make money off of you. People make money off of that. Do you know what I mean? And that's what you're talking about.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about. Exactly. And so rather than saying, oh, we're over here in our enclave of smart people who believe in scientifically based solutions, like that's the wrong framework to me. It's like, you know, let's quit writing off what those folks are saying. They're saying something that is sensible and they're using symbols to describe their experience just exactly the way these Matawai women were using symbols to explain why they did not want to give us their hair. That was not because they're ignorant. It's because of the opposite. They understand that there's something else going on and they're not in control of it. And I think, you know, I think that rhetoric and building up the divide and building up sort of the self-righteousness on the side of the academic types who are comfortably positioned and also on the side of the working class people who are forming coalition around opposing oppression from their point of view, what they think of as oppression from their point of view. that there are also systems that benefit from that. There are economic systems that benefit from that. There are media outlets that benefit from that. There are political practitioners who benefit from that. And so I think we have to reject that polarization and say, hey, let's get in the same room and say, yeah, you're right. We're screwed. You think you're screwed? I agree with you. That's right. You know, I mean, there were a lot of Black people that did not want to take the vaccine, and a lot of Latinos that did not want to take the vaccine, and immigrants who did not want to take the vaccine with good reason. With good reason. You know, these are people who've been, their bodies have been experimented on over decades. Why would we dismiss that or try and bombard them with facts? It is not helpful. They do not trust the underlying logic with good reason. And I think, you know, and so I don't know how to do that, Sherry, but I mean, it's something that I long for. And I wonder about connecting with the evangelical church to do that. So the goal is not to get evangelicals to take vaccines. Right. That's not the goal. The goal is to form coalition for our mutual interests, right? To form coalition so that we can live, so that all of us get to live.
Right.
Why make vaccines the thing we're going to fight about?
Right.
Oh, dear. You're talking to a person who's like super cozy with a lot of Republican politicians in central Washington.
Sure. No, I mean, I'm aware we're still recording, and I actually hope we can use some of what we just recorded, because I think it's true. I think it's really good. This is what I'll go back to what I said, like, this analysis that we heard coming from Richard, but that we're also putting forward in the book is basically like what you just said, like something is very deeply wrong. There really is something conspiring against life.
Yes.
And you're not crazy. And it actually is out. I think it's so symbolic that QAnon was all around sort of like the abuse of children. It's like, that's why our book is called So That We and Our Children May Live.
Yeah.
Like our children are in that sense being abused because the world they are inheriting is... what we're passing down to our children and our grandchildren is like, it's almost astounding to me that we can, that the dominant culture can even live with itself.
It's taxation.
Like, you know what I mean?
It's taxation without representation.
Yeah. And it also feels like almost like a form of child sacrifice.
Yeah, it is. The ones that are not yet born. We're exacting a tax on the ones that are not yet born. I mean, the idea that we're going to live without insects, many people don't understand. Okay, maybe they do understand how crucial insects are. If they go, we go. We can't live without insects.
No, and I just listened to a podcast. I think, you know, Nate Hagans, who is a colleague of Richard Heinberg's at the Post Carbon Institute, put out a podcast in the last month or two. And about this insect holocaust and 2% a year. And we're now actually a few years, like maybe decades into that. I think insect populations are down 40%. And we don't have that much further to go before they're at levels that can't sustain the rest of the food web.
Yeah. We can't live without them.
You know, we can't live without them. And we're not talking about just getting rid of mosquitoes, like the not ones that we don't like that actually have their own place in the food web. You know? But I have to say, of all of the sort of podcasts I've listened to, that one almost scared me the most because it felt so near term. Like we can't, like we don't have, we barely have another 30 years of losing insect populations before we're down at a level that's can't sustain the life support system of the planet.
Yeah, the irony here to me, one great irony of this Holocaust is the people who know best how dependent we are on them, farmers, are the ones that are exterminating them for short-term profit and gain. I mean, farmers know, they understand we have to have insects. We need them, you know, from the dung beetle that's rolling his little ball of poop, to the wasps that are collecting. I mean, these are the trash collectors of the world. you know, I'm speechless. We need them. And, you know, these people who are putting pesticides on crops or using genetically modified seed are also, you know, lovers of the land who are watching the destruction of their own place in the way that loggers have, and the way that, you know, people who work on, you know, on fishing boats are watching the extermination of their ability to their livelihood. And so in our dominant culture, we constantly target and then sacrifice the working class people who have so little power to change it.
Right. They're the ones who are often, I mean, I'm aware, like, folks who are fisher people or farmers or loggers, like, these are actually people who know that land or that ocean pretty intimately and have a whole lot of respect for it, but actually have to sacrifice those, not only their livelihoods, but actually often things that they really deeply value and care for, because there's no other way for them to make a go of it in the economic system.
And so a grave irony is farmers themselves administering the chemicals that are destroying the insect population that we all depend on. It's just sad. It's so sad.
Everywhere we look, we see signs that all is not right with our earth. Extreme temperatures and weather patterns wreak havoc. Pollutants sour soils, waterways, and our very bodies, and fires and floods ravage land and communities. We believe climate change is just a symptom of a larger ecological crisis. If we want change, we must realize that the solutions to the problems we face can't come through the same systems that created those problems in the first place.
Ecological justice requires that we challenge our assumptions about creation and our relationship to it. It requires decolonization. We must turn to the leadership of Indigenous communities who struggle for all life as land and water protectors. And we are calling on people of faith to join them.
We believe this so strongly, we wrote a book about it. It's called So That We and Our Children May Live, Following Jesus in Confronting the Climate Crisis. And it's published by Herald Press.
This book offers hope for a better future alongside concrete actions for joining with Indigenous peoples to protect life and negotiate with decision makers for sustainable change that follows Jesus. In these pages, we invite you with us to confront climate change and choose life for our children and the future of our planet.
We invite you to buy our book and join the conversation. Thank you.
This podcast is hosted by us, co-produced by the DD&D Coalition and Anabaptist World.
The opinions expressed here are ours, however, and do not reflect official positions of Anabaptist World.
For more information, go to anabaptistworld.org and dofdmeno.org.
Our theme music is by Micah Peplow and Shannon Kaler. Thank you.